Good morning. It is good to see everybody here this morning. It has been a while since I've been up here to preach. We've had several guest speakers come and last month and spend some time with us, so I'm very grateful for that opportunity to get to learn a little bit more about what's going on and what this congregation is supporting and doing as people go out into the world and preach Jesus. So grateful for that. In fact, that's the primary part of our theme or our idea this month is gratitude. I know this is Thanksgiving month, this is Turkey month, but we're so grateful. And we're a people that need to be grateful. We have so many things to be grateful for. And so this whole month we're going to be looking at the Psalms and we're going to be focusing on Psalms that are Psalms about gratitude. We're going to be just grateful and thankful for all the things that God has done for us through Jesus. And so this morning, I just want to ask kind of a thought question, kind of get you thinking about this. I may have asked this question before. I don't know. I probably have, but I thought it would be good in light of what we're going to be studying this morning. And here's the question. How many times has God spared your life? Anybody know? You don't know, do you? How many times has God spared your life? We really don't have any idea, right? I mean, there are probably things that we just don't want to know about. You know, I mean, I think about that often, and I think, you know, I'd rather not know, okay? I just want that to be between God, right? I don't really want to know because it would be worrisome. It would be worrisome to know how many times things could have just gone a little different and ended my life, right? And there are times when we know that. There are times that we know that. There are times when we realize that, you know, if I had gone through that light 2 seconds sooner, that probably would have been the end. Especially if you live in Lubbock and people run red lights all the time. You know, it's that whole idea that, you know, we think, whoa, that was close, you know? And we don't dwell on it too much, and we don't sit there and think about it all day. Sometimes it bothers us enough to where we do, but often we're like, whew, man, I'm glad that didn't happen that way, and we move on. But there are times when we know, but there's so many times that we don't know, where things could have just ended so differently. And there's moments like these that just kind of cause us to stop and just think and just be so grateful to God. Thank you, Lord, for sparing my life one more day. Or maybe here's another thought more in line with what we're going to be talking about in 2 Samuel verse 24. Here's another thought. Maybe there was a time in your life when you were living in such a way. You were living in such a way that you were so wrapped up in the world. You were so wrapped up in worldly things. You were so wrapped up in your own desires and sin. And you knew that during that time of rebellion that you deserved God's punishment, right? And you think, man, you know, if you die in this moment, it would be so worse for you than if you had died in your obedience. And you think about that, and you think, man, I'm so glad that I came to my senses. I am so grateful that I finally woke up and came out of that slump, that slumber, that darkness, and I came into the light, and you think, oh, it could have ended so badly. And we think back and we realize how grateful we are that God gave us an opportunity to repent, that God gave us an opportunity to change. And we are just overwhelmed by God's mercy. We're overwhelmed by God's grace, and we're overwhelmed by God's forgiveness. And there are moments like that in all of our lives when we can think back on them and just be so incredibly thankful. So I want to spend some time in 2 Samuel 24, and then we're going to be moving to Psalm 30 towards the end of this lesson. But 2 Samuel 24, God has been incredibly good to David. I mean, you just read David's life, you think about who he is. Yes, David has expressed himself as a person who has a heart for God. He has a desire to please God. David has made a number of mistakes, we know that. But God has been so incredibly good to him. And God has been so incredibly good to Israel as a whole, the people of God, providing for them, bringing them to safety, giving them a land, winning their battles for them so that God can receive the glory. And a lot of times David sees this and he recognizes that. He's the first one that comes up and says, you know, God gets the glory for this victory. God receives the glory for who we are. But there are moments in David's life where we see him kind of becoming a king of the world instead of a king of God. And I think 2 Samuel is one of those moments where we have a little bit of a lapse of judgment in David's character, where he starts looking to himself as the provider, the victor, the warrior, the king. And there's a problem that comes with that. For some unknown reason, we'll just kind of talk about this a little bit, some unknown reason, David decides that he's going to count the people. Now, God has asked for this before. It's not unusual to take a census. It's not unusual to number the people. It's not unusual to have an understanding of how many people we have. Most of the time when God does this, though, a lot of it is to see how few there are so that God may be glorified when the battle is won. And a lot of times that's how God wants us to see that. He wants us to say, okay, I want you to compare this. Look at the numbers. From a worldly perspective, there's no way you're going to win this thing. But if I'm with you, you will. And so it's a way for God to receive glory from man and man to be humbled in the presence of God's victories. In this case, David, for some unknown reason, decides he's going to count the people. Is it for military purposes? Is it for money? Is it for his own glory so that he can look at himself and everybody can look at him and he can say, look at the numbers, I've achieved greatness. I don't know exactly why David does this. Number of theories, number of ideas, maybe they're all true, but he does. And his actions anger God. His actions anger God. Now, from a worldly perspective, any king would say, well, yeah, David's just doing what kings do. I mean, that's what David's supposed to do. But David knows better, and it's angering his God. It is angering God for counting the people. Now, Joab, he is the commander of the army, and he kind of gives some counsel here. So if you would look at verse 3 of 2 Samuel 24, he says, now, may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my Lord the king still see. Right, so while you're still alive, I mean, that would be desirable. You know, may God do that. God can add those. And may that happen. You know, I wish that upon you. But why does my Lord the King delight in these things? Right, he's kind of questioning David's motives. He's saying, you know, David, why are you so concerned about this? What difference does it make? Right, if God wants to give you that many more, then that's great. If he wants to take those away, that's fine too. Right? I mean, God gives, God takes away, but God is with you. And if God is with you, you have nothing to worry about. You'll have everything you need. You'll have your funds if that's what you're looking for. You'll have your military victories if that's what you're looking for. You'll have the glory, but it's going to come through God. He's the one who provides. He's the one that protects. He's the one that is providentially working through his people. And Joab knows this, and he's kind of counseling David, but David is just kind of stubborn, right? And he goes through with the census, and he says, oh, okay, it's fine. Count the people anyway, right? I have my reasons. I'm the king, you know? Count the people anyway. And then after the fact, it dawns on him. You know, I don't know if it's like, it's probably one of those 3 o'clock in the morning moments where you wake up and you think, oh, no, I totally said that, or I did that. Or whatever it is, I don't know what it is, but at any given time, there's this moment where you kind of wake up and you think, I wish I had not done that. Wish I had not gone there. Wish I had not said that thing. I wish I had not done that. I wish I had not gone in that direction. I just wish I could take it back. And David has one of these moments where he realizes that he has sinned against his God. But that's how sin works, doesn't it? I mean, that's how sin works in a lot of our lives. When we, in the moment, we're kind of clouded. We're kind of lacking judgment. And And we may commit a certain sin, or we're around a bunch of people, and somehow that influences and messes with our judgment. And in the moment, you think, well, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to say this, or I'm going to go there, I'm going to, whatever the case may be. And then after the fact, you just wish you had never done that. And a lot of times that's how sin works, and we have to be mindful of that. We have to be careful with that, because even with wise counsel, David still went there. And so we have to be mindful that we can do that too. Even with wise counsel, we have to be leery and careful not to step over that line and go too far and do the thing that we ought not to do. So look at David's prayer. This is verse 10. David says, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, right? After the fact, after ignoring counsel, after pushing through, after this, he now feels guilty. But there's no taking that back. There's no taking that back. There's no way that David can go back and undo what he did. There's no way that David can change what he has done. There's no way that David can somehow go back in time and listen to Joab and say, oh, that's right, I shouldn't do this. And it's the same with us too, right? It's the same with us. There's no way you can take back what you have done. There's no way you can take it back once it's done. Once you have committed the sin, the only hope that you have is to make an appeal, to plea, to bring it before the only one who can bring about your forgiveness of the sin that you've committed. You lean on God's mercy, you lean on his grace, and you say, Lord, I have greatly sinned, but now I have come to realize that. Now I have come to you. Now I hope that I can make an appeal to you, my Lord and my God. Look what he says. He says, oh Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have acted very foolishly. And, you know, obviously he has, right? I mean, he knows that. Everybody knows that. God knows that. But there's this moment where God wants us to come to him and to tell him, I've done this thing, right? And we understand that if you're a parent, you know, you've done that. Or even if you have parents, which I assume everybody has had parents. But we know this idea that you feel like you can come to your parents and you tell them, you know, mom, dad, I've done this thing. And they look at you like, yeah, I already know that, right? I've just been waiting for you to come and tell me. You know, it's like, what do you mean you knew that? You know, you've known all along that I said that or I did that or I whatever. You know, it's like, yes. What I have been waiting for is for you to come to me. And that's what God does, doesn't he? He knows. He knew before he was going to do it. He knew while he was doing it. He knew after. He knew the whole time. He knew before the beginning of time David was going to commit this particular sin. And what God desires of him is to go to him, to bring his guilt to God, to him, and to lay it out on the table, to make an appeal to him, to inquire of God, right? And acknowledge that he has done something foolish, right? So basically the way the story goes is God sends Gad, he's David's seer, that's David's prophet, and communicates with David this particular message. Because sins will not go unpunished, especially when you're king, especially when you hold a place like David. The sin of the king was going to reflect upon the people. It needed to be dealt with. God is going to deal with it, but he's going to deal with it in a very unique way. That's one that we can glean so many wonderful messages from. So let's take a look. So Gad comes around, the seer, and he speaks the words of God. He says, shall 7 years of famine... This is the list of options. Shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Or will you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or, shall there be 3 days of pestilence in your land? Now consider and see what answer I shall return to him who sent me. It's pretty powerful, isn't it? And it's gonna be more powerful once we start to kind of digest and unpack this idea. But God is giving David ultimately three options as a punishment. Three options as a punishment. Not one of these is good. There's not like a get out of jail free card, right? There's not an easy one. Not a single one of these is desirable. None of them are good. The option for good is off the table. That option for good was when David received wise counsel from Joab. That was the option for good. Or when David was contemplating counting the people and he decided that's not a good idea. That's the option for good. And it's off the table. Right? We wish we would have taken that option. David wishes he had taken that option. He wished that he had taken that one. But it's not there anymore. But that's us, right? That's sin. Sin is that option. We have that moment where we have to recognize, I have to make a choice. I have an option. The options are on the table. Which one will I choose? When the option for good is off the table, the punishment option is the only one. We have to appeal to God for his mercies. That's what David is doing in this story. None of these options are good, but all have David. And I think this is really key. David is the kind of person, and maybe you're like this too, I'm kind of like this. If it's going to be a punishment, just bring it on me, right? I'll take the brunt of it. I'll take the punishment. Just whatever you're going to do, focus here, God. You know, this is where I want it. Leave everybody else alone. Focus on me. I think this punishment or these three options are so intensified because it's not about David, but the people in whom he is entrusted, the people who trust him, the people who look to him for guidance, the people who look to him as the king, they're going to suffer because of what he did. And to me, that's so much more of a punishment for David than if the punishment had come directly on him, right? And we're kind of like that too, right? When we think about our own lives. But how often, you know, if you're married and you have children, if you're a grandparent or whatever, that you do something and you think it's you know, you're doing it. It's all you. You're doing it. You're saying it. You're acting this way. You're partaking in this, whatever it is. I mean, you can kind of fill in the blanks for your own experience or life. And you think, well, I'm doing it. And you get this selfish mindset. But then you fail to realize the consequences of your actions on the people that you love, right? When our kids see us, you know, lying, I know this might be a very simple, seemingly simple concept, but I mean that idea that when they hear us lie about something and we say, well, it's just a little white lie, you know, it's not going to hurt anybody. When our kids hear their parents, when our grandkids hear their grandparents doing something that's seemingly innocent in the moment, it has enormous consequences. Because we might think, well, I'm just trying to get out of this situation, you know, and this is the easiest way out. And yeah, I know they heard me, but, you know, it's okay because it's just a little white lie. It's not that big a deal. But we don't realize how much it affects them. And we don't realize how much it affects our children when we fly off the handle and we get really angry and we just start getting really mad and we're yelling at somebody for something and our kids are watching and they're thinking, well, you know, dad's just getting mad again. How much it affects them. How much does it affect our children when we choose things that are destructive? You know, when a person, a family member, a father is involved in drugs and alcohol and their whole life is just kind of in shambles and they're thinking, well, I'm just destroying myself. It's just me. I'm the one that's getting hurt. It's not true. It's not true. Other people are being hurt because when our children grow up, when our grandchildren grow up and they get older and they're faced with that same kind of struggle, they're going to be less likely to make the right choice because of the choices that we made while we were bringing them up in our household. That is incredibly important to understand. David is the example. David is the king. David sets the example. God is catering this punishment for David. And not a single person is going to suffer, but many will suffer because of his actions. Now, David chooses, right, to take matters into his own hands. That's how this story begins. And one of the things I think that's significant about this list of these different punishments is that God is saying to David, in essence, okay, David, if you're so wise, if you're so smart, if you know how to handle the people, if you want to count the people, for, you know, then again, for whatever reason that is, now you get to choose their fate. You get to make a choice. And that's so incredibly powerful because God makes that choice every second of every day. God controls the universe. God is ruler of the cosmos. God is in control of everything. He allows things to happen, and he knows they're going to happen, and he knows the consequences, and he knows. But he has to have that kind of authority. Only God can be just. Only God can be righteous in that kind of decision. In the fate of another person, it is God in whom we desire to trust, because only God can see what the future will bring. God is the one in whom has that authority. He is the king. He is in control. He is the ruler. He is the one that is only, the only one who is fit to make those kind of choices. And God is looking at David and said, if you are so smart, if you wanted to determine the fate of your people, here you go. Make your choice. No human is fit for that. I'm not fit for that. I don't have the wisdom. I don't have the ability. I don't have any of it. But I will say this about David. He does make an incredible choice in regards to his response to God. So I want to look at the next verse, or a few verses down to verse 14. Listen to how David handles this. He says, I'm in great distress. I mean, who wouldn't be, right? He says, let us now fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercies are great. But do not let me fall into the hands of man. So the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from morning until the appointed time. 70,000 men of the people from Dan and Bethsheba died. 70,000. And David had to watch that. David had to witness that. David had to be there for that. He had to bear that upon his shoulders. But the choice he made was to hand it over to God. He wanted to say, okay, if punishment is coming, punishment's coming. There's no way to turn back the clock. There's no way to change the options. There's no way to manipulate this. Punishment is coming. If I have to choose, I want God to be the one in control of the punishment. Don't let man punish me, because they will not be fair. They will not be just. They will not be merciful. I want God to administer the punishment upon my people and my sin, because I know God to be a God of mercy. He is a God who will rightly handle the situation. Now, Psalm 30. Now, Psalm 30, debatably, but I believe it's true, is a psalm that is traditionally thought of as David writing about this particular event in his life, or one similar to it. And so I just like you to kind of read through this and think about it, how grateful this psalm really is. Even though it has some kind of dark undertones, there is an enormous amount of gratitude in David's voice. So look at Psalm 30, verses 1 through 12. He says, I will extol you, O Lord, for you have lifted me up. You have not let my enemies rejoice over me. O Lord, my God, I cried to you for help, and you healed me. You have brought up my soul from Sheol. That's death, place of death. You have kept me alive, that I would not go down to the pit. I'll look at verse 4. He says this. He says, sing praise to the Lord, you his godly ones, and give thanks to his holy name, For his anger is but for a moment. His favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may last for the night, but a shout of joy comes in the morning. So, I want you to see this. And I want you to get this point. And I want you to recognize what David is saying here. He's saying that yes, this is coming. Yes, this is happening. Yes, God is angry. God gets angry when his people disobey him, but God also brings mercy. He brings joy. And in the joy that comes after, the joy that comes after, the night after, that moment when you realize that I have sinned against my God, you've turned to God for an appeal to say, God, be merciful upon me, a sinner, and God forgives you. And the joy that comes the morning after is overwhelming and worth singing about. I think about that often when we come together as a congregation and we sing. Maybe our singing becomes just kind of routine. Maybe we do it because we feel like we have to. But do we do it out of pure gratitude for the salvation and the forgiveness? Do we wake up in the morning on Sunday and we say, yes, I get to go and worship my God, sing praises to him, and be joyful and grateful for his mercies and salvation because I belong to him? God's mercies come. God's forgiveness comes. Look at verse 6. He says, now, as for me, I said in my prosperity, which of course comes from God, I will never be moved. Oh Lord, by your favor, you have made my mountain to stand strong. You hid your face. I was dismayed. So at some point, like what we see in 2 Samuel 24, the psalmist was sure of himself. You know, he was self-reliant, he was proud, he was arrogant, he was certain of himself, he stood strong, right? We do that. Sometimes we're just so sure of ourselves, right? We're just so confident. And we go about our routine as if it's all about us, and we go to work, and we go home, and we run here or we're there, and we eat, and we go to bed, and we pat ourselves on the back for another day that we have accomplished. And we say, yes, I'm here today because I have done well for myself. I have provided for myself. I have provided for my family. I have taken care of myself. I work hard for myself. And therefore, myself stands here with myself, and here I am in all of myself's glory, right? And we do that. And we do that. But we fail to recognize that moment that we say those words, and we may not say them directly like that, but we kind of do in our actions, that moment is a gift. That God gave us that moment. God provided that moment. God spared our life for that moment to come. And in our arrogance, we boast about our accomplishments and our works and our deeds. And in reality, it is God who preserves our life in the moment, in the midst of our boasting. We ought to humble ourselves. In reality, all that we are, all that we have, all that we do is a product of God's favor, right? All that we have, all that we are, all that we do are a product of God's favor. And Psalms like Psalm 30 remind us of this. It's kind of a wake-up call to say, wake up. Wake up. It's not about you. You're not the one doing it. You're not the one accomplishing it. You think you're great? Wake up. Let's keep reading. Verse 8. He says, to you, O Lord, I called, and to the Lord I made supplication. What profit is there in my blood? If I go down to the pit, will the dust praise you? Will it declare your faithfulness? It's an interesting phrase, isn't it? It's kind of an interesting thought. And a lot of Bible scholars look at this and they kind of think it's kind of immature. It's almost like a child-like attitude. And David kind of displays that sometimes with God. Just a childlike favor of his Father, of God, of Lord. But the interesting thought is that is he's kind of thinking, anticipating death, right? That's the punishment. He's anticipating death, and he's kind of reasoning with God. And he says, you know, when I die and I become dust, will that dust sing praises to you? Will that dust go to the world and praise you and speak of your favor and your forgiveness? What's that dust going to do, Lord? It's just dust. It's not going to do anything. What's it going to do? And it's kind of like just appealing to God to say, if I die, you're going to miss my praise. If I die, you're going to miss me going into all the world and preaching and teaching and giving your favor and praising your name. You're going to miss that if I'm dust. Right? And then he says in verse 10, he says, hear, O Lord, and be gracious to me. O Lord, be my helper. Now that Hebrew word helper is really interesting. It's the word azer. And it's the same word that is used in Genesis chapter 2, referring to God creating woman, that God created a helper, an azer. And what it basically means is somebody to come alongside you and accomplish what you cannot accomplish on your own. So Adam was alone, and God created woman to come alongside him so they together can accomplish what could not be accomplished by themselves. And David is calling upon God, and he says, God, be my azer, be my helper. Come alongside me so that I can accomplish what I could not accomplish without you. What a turn of events, right? From somebody who says, I'm king, I'm going to do this for myself, to somebody who says, God, I can't do it without you. Come be my azer. Come be my helper. I cannot do it without you. Look at verse 11. He says, you have turned for me my mourning into dancing. You have loosened my sackcloth and girded me with gladness. Verse 12, that my soul may sing praise to you and not be silent. O Lord my God, I will give thanks to you forever. Nobody in this room, right? Nobody in this room knows how long God has allowed you to live and continue to live, right? We really don't have any idea. We don't know how many times God has spared our lives. We don't know how many times God has saved us from death. We have no idea how many things could have happened in our past that God caused to not happen so that we can be here this morning, so that we can be here and not dust, so that we can be here and we can sing praises to his name, so that we can be here and declare his forgiveness to the world, so that we can be here and live. We have no idea. But there is one thing that we all know. There's one thing that we all know. Every single person in this room knows this. God spared your life this far. God allowed you to be here. God allowed you to wake up this morning and walk through that door. Maybe some of us, it was difficult. Some of us, it was hard. Some of us physically, we are having a hard time being here, but we're here and God allowed you to be here. Some of us, it was just easy. You know, we just came in like we always do, but God allowed that. He has spared you so far as to come here and be with his people and give praise and to give worship. He's allowed you to be here. And if you're a parent, and I know I talk about parents a lot because I'm a parent, and as I talk about parents, but if you're a grandparent, if you have family members, if you have a relationship with somebody that you have influence on, you have to recognize that every moment that you have with them, your children, your grandchildren, your family, your friends, your coworkers, that is the gift that God has given you to be the influence that they need so that they can be part of the family of God, so that they can see in you the example of living like Christ so that their future can be in Jesus, that every opportunity that you're given is a gift. And sometimes we squander it. Sometimes we ignore it. Sometimes we abuse it. We need not forget it. God has gifted that to us. We have an opportunity to change the course of someone else's future through our obedience, our faithfulness, our actions. That's the option that's on the table each and every day. And we need to make sure we grab it before that option is gone. If you know, If you know that you're in a right relationship with God, if you know that you're saved from your sins and you're saved from death and that you belong to the church, that you belong to Jesus, you know exactly what the psalmist feels. You know exactly what he is feeling towards the end of that psalm. And when you came out of the water, right, of baptism, and you were able to rejoice because the old has been buried and the new has been raised, and you are here this morning and you've experienced that, you can say the words the psalmist said. You can repeat those words, and you can say things like that: you have turned for me my mourning into dancing. You have loosened my sackcloth, girded me with gladness, that my soul may sing praise to you and not be silent. O Lord, my God, I will give thanks to you forever. I will give thanks to you forever for the salvation that you have provided for me through your mercies, through Jesus. Now, if you have not responded to the gospel, if you have not been baptized into Jesus, if you have not gone through and done what God has asked you to do to become part of his family, you ought to be grateful this morning. You ought to be grateful this morning. You ought to be grateful that God has spared your life thus far and given you one more day, one more opportunity to respond to the gospel and become part of his family so that you can be grateful at your salvation. Whatever your needs might be this morning, maybe you've been on this path for a while and you've just lost your gratitude and you want that back and you desire prayers from the congregation. Or maybe you've never responded appropriately to the gospel and that's what you need this morning. Whatever your needs are, if you would please come forward as we stand and as we sing.